Hi everybody, this is Joanne Manister with Read Science, and today I am here with my host Jeff Schomeyer to talk about Undeniable Science with Corey Powell, who is the editor of Bill Nye's best-selling, New York Times best-selling book, Undeniable, Evolution and the Science of Creation. And here at Read Science, of course, we love to talk to book authors, book illustrators, photographers, anybody who's sharing science with the general public, communicating science. And Corey certainly fits into that category. Corey, please say hello to our audience.
Hello, audience. It is a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to be speaking with you.
We're glad to have you here, and so what I'm going to do is read Corey's biography that he graciously provided, because Corey's everywhere, and so for me to encapsulate it, I was worried I would be the one to mess up. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Corey before we start talking about his collaboration with Bill Nye on the book, which I hope you guys have read, because I found it highly readable, and I think that's the point. So, Corey S. Powell is editor-at-large of Discover Magazine, where he writes the magazine's Out There column and blog. He is also a consulting editor at American Scientist Magazine and a freelance contributor to Popular Science, Slate, Scientific American, Smithsonian, and Nautilus, where we find all our great writers. Corey spent 15 years on the staff at Discover, including 5 years as editor-in-chief. Before that, he served 8 years on the board of editors at Scientific American. Corey has coordinated partnerships with the National Science Foundation and the National Science Teachers Association, and has taught at NYU's SHRP Science Journalism Program, where he is currently a visiting scholar. He is the author of God in the Equation, which my library didn't have, so I don't have a copy to hold up for you. But yes, we have good libraries here too. So God in the Equation is an exploration of the spiritual impulse in modern cosmology. As a producer, Corey has worked on Last Days on Earth, a 2020 special for ABC News, and the Joe Genius video series for the online network Revision 3. He's appeared on CNN, MSNBC, ABC News, CBS News, and Sci-Fi Channel, and Science Friday, and is a frequent science commentator on Fox News. In an earlier life, he worked for NASA to help test gamma ray telescopes. So here we are once again, physics heavy in our in our thing.
Careful.
Every once in a while we get the biologists and we split between the biologists and the physicists. So, Corey, welcome. And what we'll do is throw the first question out to Jeff.
Absolutely.
In our first pitch.
Caught it. Thanks for being with us, Corey, and finding time in your schedule, which must take like 32 hours a day or something to get through. That's so remarkable. And I'm part of the physics heavy thing here, so we can talk later about that gamma ray project. But we're going to start talking about this book that Bill Nye and you put together. And I know, and I remember at the time, that this book grew out of what was called a creationism versus evolution debate, which is a little bit odd, I think, to start with, that Bill had with Ken Ham, a notorious, famous creationist. And for people who haven't read it yet, the book does go well beyond those bounds. It's not a summary of just that debate, but that debate is a starting point for all of the things that Bill writes about in here. But I remember at the time that, in a way, the biggest controversy that was associated with that debate was whether scientists should even be talking to creationist wackos or engaging them in any way and giving them legitimacy. What's the story? Fortunately, we got the book out of it, but, you know, what do you think about that part of the debate? How did it play out? What's the story on that sort of science journalism engaging on those questions?
Right. Well, as you say, it's a debate not just in the scientific community. It's a debate in the science journalism community as well. You know, do you engage these issues directly and try to make the case of this is what science actually says? Let's fight against the caricatures of science. Let's get people to actually understand the science, or just in having that, and framing it as a, you know, as a conversation. Do you play into the equal time problem of media coverage, that is sort of presenting the two sides as equals? And so that question goes on all the time. And I think, you know, look, I think there is a legitimate concern. There are, there is a certain tendency in the media to play things as, you know, debates of equals. And, you know, and if you, and if you fall into that trap and you start treating, a well-documented scientific point of view and, a very personal and not at all scientific point of view as equal things, you're not advancing the debate. I think, what Bill Nye decided, and what I think actually turned out, he really made the right call on this, is that if you engage the right way, and if you frame it the right way, it really can be a very productive conversation. And, my experience, these conversations are really, they're aimed at a, at a sort of a different audience than the audience you're directly engaging mm-hmm. with. I mean, the people who have a firm belief, the firm young Earth creationists, are not people who are going to suddenly say, oh, well, that's an interesting way that you describe the fossil record. I guess I'm going to renounce my faith and switch to science. They're people who have made, a lifelong theological and philosophical decision about what they want to believe and how they want to live their lives. But there's a much, much larger world out there, and that was really, that was what Bill focused on, was, where is that message going to carry out, and how is that message going to carry out? And yeah. As you say, a lot of people were very skeptical that he was doing the right thing here. A lot of people thought that he was giving, aid and comfort to the enemy. And I think, Bill's attitude in doing the debate, and then in the attitude that we had in writing the book together, is not to treat this as, we're going into the enemy camp, but really, science has this incredible story to tell. And if you just put the stories side by side, and you assume that most of the public is fundamentally rational, curious, all the wonderful things that human beings tend to be, that if you put those stories side by side and you actually say, this is what science actually says, this is the evidence of why we say it, and this is, and it's a story that doesn't have to be a cold, clinical, sterile story. It's a story that's very human, that's very exciting, that's open-ended, that, it sort of gets it, to my mind, the best impulses of what it means to be human, and actually gets, it is a better story in terms of being human and being moral and being mm-hmm. aware. And that was how Bill approached it in the debate, and then the book really tried to carry out that spirit. And yeah. Well, it's still playing out, and there's still some people who are unconvinced, but I think the book and the response to it speaks for itself.
Well, I think it's a very good outcome, because the book is, at least, that it prompted from those, because regardless of the approach they took, the book is in no way really a debunking of creationist stories, nor is it particularly mocking of creationist stories. It's a positive thing, which I think is valuable. It's the way I generally prefer to go about things, of presenting interesting and positive science stories. In some way, not entirely clear from the marketing. I think that's important for some people to know, that it's a very positive, at the same time, kind of personal look at the exciting and interesting stories and how it holds together scientifically. I think that's a remarkably good thing. It's a positive outcome.
So I'm curious, considering that this debate was with a primarily religious sect group of people, how much does your book, God in the Equation, The Exploration of the Spiritual Impulse in Cosmology, how much did that have to do with either Bill approaching you or you approaching him, play into you guys coming together for this book?
Actually, my earlier book had very little to do with this connection. The thing that actually brought me together with Bill, believe it or not, was Lyme disease, which would not be an intuitively obvious link between me and Bill Nye, since neither of us has had Lyme disease, and neither of us has written about Lyme disease. It's a strange roundabout story. Bill's editor at St. Martin's had also worked with a very good friend of mine who wrote a book about Lyme disease. and this is a Pam Weintraub, who had been the executive editor with me at Discover Magazine. Pam and the editor, Jennifer Weiss at St. Martin's, became really good friends. They kind of bonded over some shared experiences and some research that they had both done on Lyme disease. Jennifer Weiss at St. Martin's is Bill's editor. Bill was looking for a partner on the book, and so he called up my friend Pam and said, you know, I'm looking for somebody to work with here. And Pam said, oh, well, this sounds like you probably have a lot of fun working with Corey. So I sat down, I met with Bill and Bill's agent, and we had a nice dinner in Brooklyn in a nice little restaurant. And we just shared a bottle of wine. We talked about science. He told his stories. And at the end of the evening, we just thought, this is good. We want to work together. And it's funny, over all the years, obviously I knew a tremendous amount about him, but our paths hadn't crossed until we just sat down over a nice dinner and kind of shared our worldviews and realized that he and I had a lot in common.
You're credited here as editor, and that says some things to me. And what came to mind when I was reading it is that one thing you can say, and I think to his benefit about Bill Nye, is that he has a very distinctive personality and a way of saying things.
Yes.
And I want to know, in your with your editorial hat on, the book sounds, when I'm reading it, like Bill Nye is saying it. Was there any conflict? What did you do about preserving Bill's voice and making sure that you had adequate scientific precision in what was being said? Because sometimes being precise about the science can be a bit of a challenge in the voice that one writes in.
I'll tell you, the challenge with the book was in many ways almost the opposite of what I thought it would be. The problem that Bill had in his first draft was, he took the responsibility of this book very seriously. He wanted this to be an authoritative book, a serious book, and not be perceived as, this is not Bill clowning around. This is Bill really tackling a serious topic. And so, he fell into the trap that I think a lot of writers do when they try to do that, which is that, he became very serious. He became very dry. He did not sound like Bill Nye. And so, actually, one of my first conversations with Bill was that, look, this book has to be a bottle of Bill. This has to be you. So it was actually, in many ways, the opposite. Part of my role as editor was actually getting him to be himself, getting him to sound like himself. And that involves, sitting down with him and just hearing a lot of his stories, which, I have to tell you, is a lot of fun. And then a lot of the stories that we talked about conversationally ended up becoming chapters in the book. So, so he told me about his visits to Ivan. If you've read the book, his relationship with a primate.
Yes,
he talked about. He told stories about his earlier life as an engineer at Boeing, which is where he got a lot of his training. His family history, which I knew nothing about until he and I started talking, and so a lot of those bits and pieces found their way into the book. And they, and they helped me. One of the great challenges as an editor is that you want to exert control, but not too much control. It's a delicate process of how much of your own ego do you allow to seep into the work. And in this case, it was so much fun talking to him, and we both love this topic in a similar way. Bill brings a background of engineering and really speaking to a popular science audience. I bring a background of editing science magazines, working with a lot of different academic authors, and also my real passion is from astronomy and physics, from sort of a whole different world than the world that he's coming from. So we had a nice little Venn diagram of our voices and our areas of expertise. There were some places where as you go through, I hope you can't tell, but there's some chapters where I did a lot of writing and I put a lot of my knowledge in there. And there's some chapters that are really almost entirely the way Bill wrote them. And if I did it correctly, you can't tell which is which.
Right.
Yeah, now,
it seemed pretty seamless, and it also didn't seem... It seemed like a single narrative thought more than it did, a collection of disjoint essays or something. And Bill's voice did come through. That did work nicely. And the two things that you mentioned, these worries, like these personal stories, didn't just seem like digressions. They seemed like they contributed to a personal understanding of what he was talking about, as an example. And yet, you managed to put together a book that does not seem just a casual dinner conversation, but does seem like a bigger thing, because he moved beyond, the whole thing moved bigger than this so-called creationism debate and things into sort of the beauty and how everything about related to evolutionary things. So was that as easy as you made it look?
Well,
finding that balance like that, because it really is nicely balanced.
Okay, well, first of all, there was actually a whole other book that we worked on before this book that didn't quite work out, and it was when Bill did that creationist debate, and when we really sort of got the defining spark of what the book was about, what the motivation was behind this, and sort of what you were just describing, there being really a single narrative and a single impulse running through the whole book. We did not come to that immediately. So, we had some false starts. We had meetings where we talked about great ideas, and then we sat down to try to write it and make it work and couldn't figure out what to do with it. There's always, you pull back the facade and there are a bunch of 2x4s and rusty nails and things that actually are propping the whole thing up. There's a much more complicated backstory. But the fact is, after the debate, and once we really, we really philosophically understood what we were doing with the book, it came together remarkably quickly. Compared to some of the stories of people who work on books for years and years, the bulk of this book was written really in a period of about 3 months, which it was a marathon session. During that time, Bill was originally living full time. Out in Los Angeles, in Studio City, and he got a place in New York so that he could be closer to me and closer to his publisher and closer to his East Coast events. And so, there's some nights we sat down and he has a particular ruby port that he likes, and he would pour little cups of ruby port and we would work as late as we needed to work in order to make that thing happen.
Then you wake up the next day and go, wow, do I have to edit this?
Am I still an editor?
So this is what I've been saying to people. When I first got my copy, I looked at this and I went, so even though, as Jeff pointed out, it doesn't seem like disjointed essays, I feel like each chapter can stand on its own. Like you could read just one chapter and then set it down and come back to it later, which I think is actually somewhat genius for the general public who may not read much science at all. You got an easily readable chapter that's not very long, that's not weighing down. So this is very Bill Nye, and I thought that was really wonderful. So you guys did a great job with that. I felt like that was the real strength of this book. It was funny because when, I've got an advanced reader copy and sometimes they don't have everything in it. So I didn't think much at first when I saw there was not, references in the back to each thing. But then people started to say when they got the book, they're like, outrage. Why aren't there references? Why aren't there references? So I had to go to the bookstore and make sure that was really true. So what's the deal with that? So, because that's, just a hallmark of popular science books, that we reference our science, even though he does say names of people, including Neil Shubin, and he mentions people. It's not like he's saying, I know everything, But yeah, what's the deal with that?
It's a good question. It's something that the book was coming together so quickly that I didn't really think that through at the time, but yeah, I do regret not putting in a reference section, especially for readers who want to dig deeper. As you say, we included a lot of specific names and references throughout the text, as we're going, and you know, we're working on we're working on a tight schedule and a length guideline from the publisher, and that was something that basically we ran out of time, we ran out of space, because the publisher hadn't really allocated for it, it was something that just didn't come together. I could offer the justification that these days, it's really easy to look up a lot of these things online, and it's not as big a barrier as it used to be, but it still is. I agree. For a book like this, it's an unfortunate oversight. That's probably the one thing about the book that I do really regret.
That's actually really good to hear, because I was in my head going, why would they not put this? And you know, like I said, I overlooked because I thought, oh, I just got this, and you know, you maybe didn't have time when people are sending it out to people to review. So, but that's excellent to know. And actually, I'd like to bring up one other critique that has sort of come up. This may not be for you, as you can imagine, what it's going to be is that chapter on the GMO, which was. I guess also aired as one of Bill Nye's episodes in the past, and just, you know, sort of he's pro-science in lots of ways, and then this GMO saying, wait a minute, maybe this science is moving too fast. And, so there are a lot of people who are very, very upset about this. So what's your take on this?
Well, you have, of course, zeroed in on the one place where Bill and I had a serious debate.
Okay.
We had a lot of spirited conversations about that chapter, and the conversations actually continued after the book. And you're asking this question at a very interesting time. So, you know, I've been in contact with Bill about, you know, it was an open-ended conversation while we were writing the book, and after we were writing the book, we continued to talk about this. And I passed along to him some of the reactions that I was hearing from the scientific community and from the science journalism community about that chapter. And Bill decided that he was going to go down to, he was going to meet with the president of Monsanto and meet with some of their scientists and hear their side of the story. And this happened just this past week.
Oh, and great.
So it's a very timely question. He came back and he has, I think he's really kind of shifted a lot of his thinking as a result of these conversations with the researchers. So, you know, he did the thing that you do when you're a scientist, which is you gather more information and you leave open the possibility of changing your mind based on new data. So he's actually in the process of, you know, there's going to be a paperback reissue of the book, and he and I are just starting to talk about sort of what is that. You know, we're going to make some changes to that chapter and probably add some add a note about why it's changed. So we're just starting to talk about what that will be. I actually have not had this is so new. I've not had a chance to talk through with Bill kind of where exactly his thinking is right now. But
right.
Of course, but it sounds like he's moved a bit in my direction, which is always it's personally gratifying. But I think it's also it's a tribute to what happens when you can have an open and honest debate. And which is really a lot of the core of what the book is about. But Bill was coming at this with a set of ideas, which they're not irrational ideas. I think his idea, the biggest thing that he was concerned about was the sort of the ecosystem aspect of GMOs, and sort of how they play out really in a broad evolutionary perspective. And that's a hard question to answer. That's a lot harder to answer than are they safe to eat, where the science is very clear. And so, he had a question that was, that's why, what he and I were doing was a real, it was really a debate. I didn't feel like I was in a position where I could just say, Bill, you're absolutely wrong, because he was asking some very subtle points. But he came to this from the point of view of, maybe I'm wrong. This is what I see from the science I know. Mm-hmm. I want to learn more. I want to find out if it's true. And that's the whole message of the book. The whole message of the book is, when you're coming at things without ideology, but when you're coming at them from a genuine curiosity and excitement of how the world works, you can change your mind. And there's nothing more exciting than changing your mind because you've learned something new. And
this is so commendable, and I'm so glad he's doing that, because that wasn't that the critique levied. They were like, he's so.
Yes.
open to the science, but here in this chapter, suddenly he's not. And people who are biologists who have actually sort of modified organisms in the lab already is sort of like, well, you know, not saying there should be no oversight, but wait a minute, wait, I don't think he's got the full picture. Maybe it would be nice if he went in a lab and spoke with scientists. And so I'm so glad to hear that this is what's happening, and I'm sure our listeners are going to be so thrilled to hear this. No?
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's happening right now, so yeah. I'm sure there's going to be a, he and I are going to have some more debates. I have no doubt about it. But it's, you know, I think his thinking has definitely shifted on here.
I think so that came through for me. Sorry, just a last gloss. But when I read it, it's easy for me as the physical scientist perhaps to have a sort of caricatured view that's a little too clear. And when I read it, I thought I got the impression of a person who was looking at it scientifically, which is the point of the book and is a very good thing, and who also was not just pretending to be objective, but hadn't made up his mind and had some questions. And so I thought there was a real honesty that didn't bother me, because it made me think about some things that I could find too, you know, comfortable to avoid otherwise, that I thought were quite valuable parts of the conversation. Sorry, Joanne.
Oh, that's okay. That's fine. I think as a biologist, I was looking at that going, well, you know, it's still the thing's not out, you know, the verdict's not completely out. And, of course, we think about these things. But what I was going to say is someone did question on the Q&A, Corey, would you and Bill and the publisher consider doing a web-based reference section? So when you're doing your paperback, do you think you'll be able to put up a reference section?
That's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about that. I don't know that St. Martin's normally supports that, but that might be something that you know, Bill could support through his website. It's a good idea.
You know, especially since, you know, if you said you, I mean, you're aware that it was sort of an iffy thing, but that I've heard from so many people that this really bothered them, and I thought, well, that seems, you know, making a reference section isn't easy, but it is a relatively easy thing to do. You know, it's time, it's whatever, but make people feel, you know, happy. How can we help? So, that's great. Great. Thank you. So, actually, I should click done. This Q&A app, by the way, someone has put a question up here. If you have a question for Corey about what he does separate from Bill or what he has done in coordination with Bill, feel free to just come to the site and just type in your question.
All right. Maybe I get to shift. I have a sort of big question. It all has to do with things that tie into who your audience was for this book. And when I'm a member of the American Physical Society, and decades ago, there was a debate in the pages of Physics Today, you can imagine how wild and crazy that was, that had to do with trying to engage the public, because people took that very seriously, and they still do. But the question was how to do that with an idea of, you know, there's 20% of people who just are not being engaged. And one person, I thought, wrote fairly insightfully and said, at least right now, I said, there are always people who are not interested in hearing. They don't want to know more about science, and they're not going to listen if you try to tell them. So who's your audience? How do you reach people? I want to talk about finding people, engaging people, and is there really, you know, a 20% that just don't want to hear anything, and we might as well forget them?
Sounds very Mitt Romney there. So, just a quick aside, my very first job in science publishing was working for Physics Today. So I actually have a connection back to the American Institute of Physics and the funny thing is, yeah, the staff, yeah, the writers and the editors on Physics Today were a very funny and articulate bunch, and you wouldn't always know that by reading the magazine. So. That was back to that, you know, that distinction between the science as we live it and science as we write about it is sometimes quite a gap between the two. I think I have no idea what the percentage is, but certainly, you know, if you look at you know, like Gallup polls of American attitudes towards science, there is a segment, and it probably is, 20% is probably not too far off. There's a segment who just philosophically, ideologically, they don't live their lives by scientific evidence. I mean, you know, obviously they enjoy cell phones and the internet and all the, you know, the things of technology like the rest of us, but they have, you know, it's not that they're unaware of science, it's that they have made a very specific personal decision that, on key issues, faith trumps evidence. And, you know, and that is it's a personal decision, but, those are people who are, they're not going to be swayed by more evidence. You know, once they've made that decision, you can't pile on the evidence and expect that all of a sudden they're going to change their behavior. But there's a huge portion of the public which is genuinely curious, and I think and in many cases genuinely uncertain about what scientists really believe, how much certainty there really is, how much trust to put in some of these different narratives. And what Bill is very, very good at is, is talking in a heartfelt, conversational, very personal way that really connects with people. And so one of the extraordinary things of working with Bill is not just about our interactions one-on-one, but watching him walk down the street, and people recognize him because he's a kind of distinctive-looking guy. Mm-hmm. But it's not just they recognize him. They have a very emotional response to him. They feel like because of his persona that he's a friend. He's an approachable person. That he's somebody who they want to be associated with. And I think that's a tremendous tool for outreach. Is breaking down that barrier that sort of like there's your life and there's the sort of the scientific outlook. And scientific outlook maybe produces things that filter down into your world. It's not really a world that you would be welcome in or you'd be comfortable in. And I think for a lot of people, even people who are very very interested in science and very aware of science, there is that kind of remove. And the extent you can peel that back, I do think you win over people who are who are just not that interested. And the people who are interested, you actually get them to look at the science in a different, more personal way. I had a conversation. This was, I guess, I think it was this was last year at an American Astronomical Society meeting. I was talking to Saul Perlmutter, who won a Nobel Prize for the discovery of dark energy, the discovery that the expansion of the universe is speeding up. And now that he's won a Nobel, he says now he has the luxury to do things beyond just his normal research work. Right. And one of the things he's doing is science outreach. And what he said with that was very interesting. He says, if you look at the recent American elections, even like a 2 or 3% swing of the vote one way or the other could have changed the outcome of a lot of elections. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to reach 100% of the public. If you can find if you can find 5% of the public who are currently not engaged or who don't really understand the message of science or who are genuinely confused by these kind of like competing narratives of who has authority and who has the right version of the story. If you can persuade really a very small part of the public, you can really change a lot of the legislative directions. And what we've seen again and again is when the elections change and the legislation changes, there's a weird thing happening. People's attitudes change with it. I think you're seeing that, for instance, with gay marriage right now. A number of small but important decisions have produced this enormous change in public attitudes. And so I do think there's this incredible multiplication factor that's out there. If you can just, even just sort of break down some of the usual barriers and get rid of some of the usual language of communication and connect with people in a different way.
So for these unengaged that we're sort of thinking about right now, do you think it's less an issue that they are not interested and more an issue that they feel alienated or intimidated that science, doesn't want them to come in?
Well, I think it's, these are not, it's not an either or question because there are all of these different populations. I mean, there are, there, you know, there, 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 there's some who are just not curious. There's some who are curious but intimidated. There's some who are curious but too busy. I think there, you know, there's a lot of different reasons of why people hold back. Okay, you know, and I understand. You know, we're in a media saturated, information saturated society. There are a lot of things competing for your attention, and you know, if you know, I think there are a lot of people who are aware of science, but it's not something that matters that much to them. You know, they're not hostile to it, but it's just not really, you know, it's not a part of their lives. And again, I think and part of the reason is that because science is associated with you know, a somewhat difficult and abstract language. You have to kind of work at it a bit to understand these stories. Even if you see a really cool headline, and you're scanning through Yahoo News, and there's something about black holes, and you just say, "Oh, that sounds cool," but I doubt I can really read that story. And you know, I hear a lot of versions of that from people, and I think that's where a book like Undeniable really performs an important service. You know, there's nothing. You know, Bill and I worked really hard to make sure there's no point in the book where somebody should feel uninvited. That you know, the idea should be that you're welcome throughout. You know, and he says even at the beginning that you know if you're a person of religious faith and you're coming at this just as sort of like you know see oh well what are those people on the other side talking about. You're welcome too. Everybody is welcome here. This is not a, as you said earlier, this is not a, you know, this is not a gotcha book to say, oh yeah, well you people on the other side, you know, you stupid people, here's the real story. There's plenty of those conversations. That's what Twitter is for. That's what the internet's for.
Right.
There are plenty of people who are out there. If you want to hear insults, there are plenty of places you can go to hear insults. That's not what we're here to do.
Right, especially something as permanent as a book. You know,
right.
not as ephemeral as Twitter. Well, yes. Although that can be a bit sticky too. That can follow you for a long time. I've always thought, you know, when people, you know, a lot of, especially early in science communication, when people are just starting communication, they, you know, they'll be like, but you have to love science. It's wonderful. It's excellent. And why doesn't everybody love science? But I always took it this, you know, if I turned this around and said, what's something that doesn't really interest me or get me pumped up, like accounting, right? Accounting is important. Accounting is everywhere in the world. Accounting probably has a unique beauty to it that I don't appreciate. But if there was someone, a Bill Nye of accounting, I could probably be swayed to put more accounting in my life without kicking and screaming. You know what I mean? So,
yes.
So science is the same way, and maybe even more intimidating than accounting. But you know, that's where I always have this compassion when I want to talk about science and friendliness and soft sell, really, because you know these, as you said, I love. Actually, I'm probably going to put this in a tweet. You just categorize people, not curious, curious but intimidated, curious but too busy. I thought, what a wonderful, you know, we've got all sorts of people we're trying to communicate with. So, yeah, so take on science. So,
storytelling is a very, very natural form of human communication. You saw a movie and you loved it and you want to persuade somebody else. You tell them about the movie. You don't summarize the plot and tell them the cast. You tell them a story about the movie and why you thought it was a really cool movie. That is one of the most essential aspects of human communication. And you know, if somebody isn't interested in science or doesn't feel welcome in science for whatever reason, I feel like I want to do the same thing. I want to tell them the stories that explain why I think, why I find these scientific ideas so incredibly exciting, so compelling. You know, why when you understand evolution, you understand your own personal connection to all these incredible things in the world. Mm-hmm. I know my background is in astronomy. I know lots of people. You go out on a clear night and you point out the stars. They think that's kind of cool, and they start telling them stories that fuzzy patch in Orion. That's a place where new stars are being born, and when they're born, they fly out, and the rest of the stars that make that pattern, that constellation, those are actually stars that were born in that little fuzzy patch, and they migrated out. And you know, and you're seeing stretches of time, you're seeing processes, and you're seeing birth and death, you're seeing all this incredible stuff, and we are a part of that. And you know, when you can start framing things that way, you start to see people reacting a different way. And I always hope that it's a lasting, you know, that those things can be lasting changes.
Now,
so let me ask Jeff before you start.
Yeah, go ahead.
Jeff will ask his next essay question. Let me jump in first. So you have a long career. You've done a lot of things, you know, and so aside from this wonderful thing you've done with Bill, have you had a time, an article, a something where you went, wow, I had no idea that this was going to have such a positive impact, or you felt like you reached a lot of people and you thought, well, what did I do that made that so successful, and can I repeat that?
That's a good question. It's a hard question. You know, I mean, a lot of my years at Discover, I was a features editor, and then the editor of the magazine as a whole. And you know, when you're an editor, you're operating behind the curtain. And so you see things like, oh, this was a successful issue, or this article really clicked. And sometimes it's hard to know. There's this complicated alchemy behind that. Of, you know, how much of it is what I did, how much of it is what a writer did, how much of it is what an art director did, or just inherent interest of the topic. But yes, I could see the kinds of things that clicked with our audience. Especially at Discover, big idea stories about about the origin of life, about human origins, about the beginning and the fate of the universe. Things were actually it's almost like the further we went from everyday life, the more excited people got, and I found that really interesting. That when we would talk about gene therapy and carbon emissions and things like that, people were interested. But when you pull back onto these bigger stories, people would get really excited. And some of that is particular to the Discover magazine audience. But I do think that there's also sort of a larger message there that on the one hand, people are sort of saturated with pragmatic information about how things work, but people are often sort of starved for the bigger picture of why things matter and sort of why do scientists actually do these things? They built this incredible, they found planets around other stars. It's really incredible, but like, why did they do that? It's an exciting story or it's a pointless story, depending on how you tell it. It's either a collection of little dots on a chart, or it's the exploration of the universe, carrying out the greatest traditions of human adventure, depending on how you approach it. So I think that was probably a big lesson that I took from my years of working in different magazines is seeing that hunger for the big picture, for the sort of the kinds of stories that really do fill in that sort of existential hunger of why are we here and how does all this stuff work? There are things that I think are in some ways are less and less discussed in public life these days. It used to be church going was almost like a universal thing, and if you go back 200 years in America, that was a social core. Whether or not you had faith, everybody went to church, everybody heard sermons, everybody had that common conversation. And in many ways, science can provide a lot of that common conversation if you can let it and if you can figure out how to unleash it.
These are evidently themes that weigh on your mind, because I was reading your blog morning.
Absolutely. Yes.
And I wrote down several things. I said, I'd really like to talk about this, and they all are pretty much variants of this question. So any one of these could be, two blog posts. One, how can you talk about space exploration at a time like this with the idea that, we've got serious issues. Why are we talking about science and these dreamy things, which seems like is almost answered when you start the question on the blog post that I thought was really important, because I agree with the view. You say, why do we explore? And your simple short answer was, we explore because it's what living things do. That's the essay question. That's what you were just talking about, that there's not enough scope for dreaming, for feeling, for reaching out, for exploring. And science is a great exploration of things, yes?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I'm glad you picked that line, because it's something that I felt really strongly about. When you try to define what life is, what are the essential qualities of life? Life processes energy. Life reproduces. Passes on others of its kind. It passes along information. Part of the essential quality of to do that, to find resources, to find a mate, all those things. There's an underlying fundamental aspect, which is exploration, which is you're always testing out your environment. And this is true if you're a single-celled organism. That's part of what you do. It is absolutely hardwired into the definition of what it means to be alive. It's hardwired into the definition of what distinguishes life from non-life. So when I think about, what is the essence of being human? Why do we have these marvelous brains and this great binocular vision and all these fabulous things that we can do? These were things that that were adapted over millions and billions of years to allow you to explore your environment, to compete successfully. We've acquired these things and taken them improbably to a much higher level, where this the ability to see and process information, explore our environment, has gone beyond what it takes to survive, to the point where we know the shape of our galaxy, we know the age of the universe, we know how the first stars formed, we know what life was like 500 million years ago on this planet, things that are totally removed from the human experience of time and space, from the kind of scales that we operate in. But those explorations are straight extrapolations of the kind of exploration that's intrinsic to life itself. And so, to me, I feel like when you do those things and when you talk about those things, you're more alive. I mean, you are just fundamentally doing more of what it is that life does. And I think that I try to think really seriously about what draws people to religious faith, and why do they sometimes consider their religious faith at war with science? And I feel like it often comes down to that to that question of why are we alive? And I think that a perception in some quarters that that religion tells you why you're alive, and science tells you there's no point. There's no point to being alive. Your life, frankly, and there are even a few scientists who will happily peddle that point of view in, I think, a very counterproductive way. And I think, there's nothing in science that says that. In fact, it's sort of antithetical to what science is about. Science is all about why we're alive. It's all about, about what it means to be human. Even the most, the driest, most esoteric journal article that at first blush, you would never sit down to read it for fun, but if you ever stop and think, well, some person dedicated his life to doing that, or her life to doing that. Why did that happen? Right. What makes a person dedicate a lifetime to studying this thing? And there's always a story. There's always a deep-seated reason. And people don't dedicate their lives to doing things for no particular reason. They're scientists, as a category, could probably even be making a lot more money with a lot less work doing something else. But they choose to do these things that they do, and that's whenever anybody chooses to do something that's harder and less lucrative than what they could be doing, you have to ask, well, why? But there's a good story there. And I feel like that's you're right. It's a theme that I come back to again and again in my writing, because I think it's very interesting to me personally. It's very fulfilling to me personally, but I also think it's a very important thing to talk about to the larger world.
It's a fundamental idea. I think you're right. I agree. Do you agree, Jordan?
I absolutely agree. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we've got consensus. If three of us agree, it's got to be true.
Okay.
And we're even streaming, telling people, yes. So it's even more true.
Right. That's right. So there was the long essay question. Here's a short one. If you're talking to a class of people, aspiring science journalists, do you have a couple of prime directives that you give to them and say, as an ethical science journalist, you must be sure that you do this or these things? I have a few things in mind, but I want to know what yours are.
Well, it's not an abstract question because I used to teach a regular class at NYU, and I still guest lecture there, mm-hmm. And so I frequently do come in and talk to them about the science journalism process. I think there's some general principles. There's some fundamental principles of communication. Every story should have answer the question so what. Every question should answer the question why does this matter, and I always press them on this idea of radical clarity. You have to understand all the ideas in the story inside and out in order to be able to explain them. And you need to be able to understand them at the complex level before you can explain them at the simple level. That's not direct. I guess that's not exactly an answer to the ethics part of your question, but it's a part of that there's a pact between the writer and the reader that whatever you tell them, however complex or however simple it is, that you're not hiding anything. You're not hiding anything about the story itself, and you're not hiding anything about your own ignorance about the story. And I think that second part is really important, because I think there's a lot of misinformation that's based not on a deliberate agenda, but just on a lack of understanding. In some vague moral sense, you'd say, deliberate deception is worse than an accidental error. But functionally, they do the same thing. If you're passing misinformation to the public, you're passing misinformation to the public, whichever way you're doing it. So I do think there's that sort of a double-edged aspect of ethics. And so I really try to emphasize both parts of it, because I think the traditional curriculum talks a lot about that first type of ethics. Don't be deceptive. Don't take money from sources. Things that are that need to be repeated, no matter how obvious they are, because they are so important. But it's that second level of deception, just through ignorance or sloppiness, that is it's pervasive and it's corrosive.
Does the need for understanding then inform solutions for the criticisms of some science reporting that of false dichotomies and trying to achieve balance and too much of, he's an idiot, but as long as I quote him, he's part of the balanced story. Is there some way that we can ameliorate that without maybe having journalists be the final arbiters of truth either? But where is real reporting in all of that?
You threw me a hard question there. there are economic forces at work, and there are problems of building building audience. There are a lot of pragmatic business reasons why bad or sloppy or this is sort of like this false dichotomy reporting happens, and I don't pretend to think that I have the kind of answer or the kind of clout to enforce an answer of how to deal with all that, but I can tell you from the inside of having been on TV a number of times, having worked with a lot of different television editors, where you see a lot of that false dichotomy type reporting, mm-hmm. and you meet the people behind it, and they're often they're they're perfectly lovely people. You know, they're not, you know, they're not these, you know, these mustache twirling villains. they're people who are, you know, they're interesting, they're engaged, they want to do a good job, they want to reach a public, but they feel pressured from their producers, or, you know, in many cases, they feel like they don't actually have the intellectual firepower to push back. And you know, the pressure from the producers, I don't know, you know, that's a higher level problem. But you know, not having the intellectual firepower to push back, that's actually, you know, that's a more tractable problem. But, you know, there are ways, again, by breaking down some of these barriers and by emphasizing, you know, this idea that, you know, part of journalistic ethics is just really, really understanding your story. You know, when people have mastery over the ideas, they tend to push back. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, people have egos, and people have sort of moral senses and, you know, senses of certain personal righteousness. And I think those are wonderful tools. I think they're incremental. These are what I'm describing here is not. It's not, you know, a landslide transformation. It's an mm-hmm. incremental process. Mm-hmm. But I think it's at least a part that's small enough that I can convince myself that I can kind of move that part of the lever, even if I can't move that whole giant machine.
Yeah. I think it's a great answer. Thank you.
Well, and you're talking about the false dichotomy, and of course I loved John Oliver's segment with Bill Nye on it, you know, about climate change. And now, it's like, you know, we had our two detractors and then, you know, 99 scientists or 97 scientists plus Bill Nye. So right. I'm sure everybody's seen that, but I still love it. It's wonderful.
I just have to throw in that other John Oliver line that I loved. I think he was talking about climate change. He was talking about one of the false dichotomy issues in science, and he was like, he said, this isn't a question where, like, people get to vote of whether or not it's true. It's like asking people, are there owls?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly. It's so, I mean, he's brilliant, and I look forward to seeing more wonderful science things from him on top of everything else. But I can't believe an hour has passed, and this happens all the time, Jeff. We have to do something about time because...
Yeah.
Yeah,
we'll have to talk to someone about relativity or something.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I know a guy who knows a guy who knows Einstein.
Right, right. And how he got it wrong, perhaps.
So, Corey, we will ask you right now if you have anything else that you want to add before we say goodbye to our kind audience who has stayed with us and listened to your wonderful stories about
communication. Oh, well, thank you. I guess, you know, the part of the story we didn't get to talk to about so much was sort of, you know, from the astronomy and physics side, the other side of my life. But, you know, look, Jeff mentioned a number of things that I've written about on my blog, and I would love it if people would come by. I'd love it if people would comment. I as much as it terrifies me sometimes, I enjoy reading the comments. I love hearing, you know, what people have to say. So,
This is your blog out there on the
Discovery Magazine Blogs Network. Yeah.
And we'll add the URL to the bottom of
thank you.
The post.
Yeah, I'll make a link to that, and the next time we're together, we can start with the gamma ray telescope, perhaps.
Okay, excellent. I love talking about gamma rays.
I'll go, I think I know something about that.
Yeah.
So you'll be educating me.
I'll bring in the Incredible Hulk. It'll be fun.
Yes.
Ooh, awesome. Yeah. You know, my favorite story, I'm going to take a minute here, my favorite story about the Incredible Hulk, the movie by Ang Lee, is that his wife's a microbiologist who actually attended U of I, University of Illinois, where I'm at, and that she helped make sure that the laboratories on the set look like proper scientific laboratories.
Awesome.
That's my favorite story about the Hulk. So
those things serve their purpose. It's important.
Thank you. So thank you to everyone who tuned in to listen about science communication and Bill Nye's wonderful book, which really anybody could read this. And I suggest picking up a copy, and I look forward to what's new when the paperback comes out. So you may, if you have a hardback copy, there may be some changes in store when the paperback comes around. And I appreciate Corey answering questions about that and telling us how you worked together with Bill on this book. And I thoroughly enjoyed today's conversation. And, of course, I want to thank you, Corey, and thank you, Jeff, as always.
Oh, yeah, Joanne and Jeff, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for giving me this this opportunity to talk.
Yeah, and it was great to shake your hand the other day at AAAS. Yep. Those of you who don't know big science meetings, that's the American Association for the Advancement of Science, who has a giant meeting every Valentine's Day for some strange reason. It's that day. So we could all celebrate our love of science, if not our loved ones. But all right, thank you, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Read Science. Oh, I'm hitting the wrong button.